Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Dr. Martin Luther King, in his famous I Have a Dream speech, envisioned a day when people would be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. Arguments can be made about whether we have or will ever reach that day. Some envision a post-racial society where humanity's racist tendencies are wiped out and we never make distinctions of any kind about skin color. Penn State anthropology professor Nina Jablonski notes that we are both united and divided by skin color. She calls it the meeting place of biology and everyday experience, a product of human evolution that is perceived within the context of human culture. Today on the program, we'll talk with Nina Jablonski about the biological and social meaning of skin color. It's the subject of her new book entitled Living Color. In it, Dr. Jablonski provides a detailed explanation of the biological variances that lead to so many different shades of skin color in humanity, and she explores how humankind, from its earliest civilizations to today, has sought to categorize itself through this particular biological trait. Dr. Nina Jablonski, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Craig. It's great to be with you today.
Glad to have you with us. And as we begin our discussion, we welcome your questions and comments as well at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on WILL's Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Dr. Jablonski, what intrigued you about skin color, both biologically and societally, that led you to want to write a sort of comprehensive explanation and history of it?
Well, I guess, Craig, I've been interested in skin pigmentation for many years, over 20 years, and most of my research had dealt with the evolution of skin pigmentation and why people come in different colors. But this work naturally developed into an examination of how people perceived one another with different colors. And so really the book grew out of my interest in trying to put this all together for myself and then present it to other people. Because skin color is something that everyone notices, but very few people talk about, and yet it is something of great social importance that mediates the way that many people interact with one another. And so to me, it struck me as something that was important to understand and extremely important to communicate. So it took me several years to do this research and write the book, but I'm happy that I did.
Well, let's start where you start in your book with the biological factors that determine our pigmentation. What is it about each one of us that defines the color of our skin?
Well, I think we need to go back a little bit in human evolution just to set the stage, because our species, modern Homo sapiens, evolved in Africa, and all of us, all of our ancestors, were originally very darkly pigmented. In the course of time, and I should point out that our species first evolved in Africa around 200,000 years ago, and more than half of our history was spent only in Africa as we underwent a lot of cultural change and technological advancement and dispersal into various parts of Africa. Around 80,000 years ago, the first populations of modern people, and they were very small groups, left Africa and dispersed elsewhere into the old world. And these people faced very different ultraviolet radiation conditions. That is, the sunlight had a different composition and was less intense outside of equatorial Africa especially. And so these populations, to make a long story short, underwent changes in skin pigmentation due to genetic mutations. These changes led to loss of pigmentation, and these changes were important in order to keep people healthy as they moved into areas of lower sunlight and less UV. And so the the gradient of pigmentation that we see among people today. If we look at equatorial people, most of them are darkly pigmented. If we look at people living at higher latitudes or closer to the poles, most of them are lightly pigmented. This gradient actually evolved in relation to ultraviolet radiation regimes and in relation to keeping healthy under those regimes. And so people who developed light pigmentation actually did so secondarily after all of us originally had been dark. And the light pigmentation was necessary to allow us to continue to live healthy lives and especially to continue to produce vitamin D in our skin under reduced UV conditions at high latitude. So that's a very thumbnail sketch of how this beautiful gradient, this sort of sepia rainbow, as I call it, of skin pigmentation in humans evolved.
Now, there have been other hypotheses out there for why there are so many variations in skin color throughout history.
Oh, yes. And some of them have been quite tenable, and some of them have just been sort of wild and not very tenable. There have been ideas that we evolved dark pigmentation for purposes of camouflage or even to resist disease, that melanin pigment, which imparts dark color, helps to fight disease. And also, there have been ideas that light pigmentation was better for people living in northern climes because it helped them resist the effects of frostbite. But these hypotheses have mostly come and gone because they have not been able to be established by empirical fact.
You mentioned melanin. What is it exactly?
Melanin is a really interesting pigment. Most forms of melanin are dark color, very, very dark brown. The prominent form of melanin found in nature is called eumelanin or true melanin, and it's a remarkable pigment that's very, very a heavy molecule, very complex molecule that is remarkable because of its ability to absorb ultraviolet radiation. So when sunlight impinges on melanin, the structure of the molecule actually changes as it absorbs the energy of ultraviolet radiation from the sun. So melanin is a beautiful natural sunscreen, and people who have more natural melanin in their skin are naturally able to protect themselves from the harsh rays of the sun better than those who have less melanin in their skin.
So is it fair to say you can have too little melanin?
It is absolutely fair to say. And of course, we see this today because many people whose ancestors evolved, let's say, at high latitudes in Asia or in Europe, now live in places where there's a lot of sun. For instance, people whose ancestors may have evolved originally in northern Europe, including Scandinavia, may now find themselves in Arizona or Belize. And those people now face tremendous problems because their skin does not have enough natural melanin or the ability to make melanin. And so when they are faced with very, very strong sun, their skin responds by not developing a tan, but developing a sunburn, which is very painful and can lead to many more serious consequences. So lightly pigmented people who live today or even vacation today in very sunny places face a lot of problems because they don't have enough natural pigment.
Can you have too much melanin?
Yes. By the same token, you can have too much. And again, we can point to the fact that many people who have too much melanin, well, I should say too much for the environment, are those who have moved to low UV environments quite recently in history. Remember, people in the last 500 years have been moving around at tremendous rates over, over increasing distances. And so we're able to live really far away from where our ancestors originally lived. And so many darkly pigmented people whose ancestors originated in equatorial Africa or the subcontinent of India would now live, let's say, in the northern U.S., perhaps around where your listeners live, and face really reduced solar and UVB conditions. And what this results in is a problem with vitamin D deficiency often, because the people with dark pigmentation have naturally a lot of sunscreen in their skin, and so even normal casual sun exposure isn't enough to allow them to make enough vitamin D to satisfy their physiological needs and keep them healthy. And so they can frequently suffer from vitamin D deficiencies.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Dr. Nina Jablonski, a professor of anthropology at Penn State University. She's the author of Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color, and we're discussing the biology behind skin pigmentation and how it has been perceived and how it has defined various societies throughout human history. We welcome your questions and comments for Dr. Jablonski at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Beyond those geographical shifts, how is skin color as a biological function in the modern world different from ancient human civilizations?
Well, I think the main difference, Craig, would be that we don't really challenge our skin color as much, or I should say we challenge it under different conditions, because many people today living on the earth are living in cities, and they're not spending time out of doors. This is the huge difference between people of even a few hundred years ago and today. So many of us, even those of us who live close to where our ancestors evolved, are living in cities and spend time indoors. And so our pigmentation, in a sense, isn't ever challenged by sunlight. And often people who live indoors, regardless of whether they're close to their ancestral homeland or not, experience vitamin D deficiency. And so this is a real interesting problem of modern life. And I would say this is probably one of the biggest public health problems that now faces people worldwide, especially in an increasingly urbanized world.
Let's take a call. We have George on the line from Champaign. Good morning, George. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Very interesting show. I just caught the last 10 minutes here, and I had a couple questions for the doctor. One you sort of answered with the question of urbanization and people spending more time indoors. Specifically, my question was in reference to, relative to evolution, we're wearing a lot more clothes, which restricts the amount of sunlight to us. But another broader question, and then I'll get up here and listen, is how this affects us physiologically. And it's got to be, I personally suffer from sleep disorder, restless legs, and I'm convinced that it has to do with my intake of sunshine. But anyway, I'll just throw that out there and listen off air. Thank you,
George. These are really good questions. To your first question about clothes wearing, there is no doubt that clothes wearing has had a significant effect on our physiology. We normally think about it as just sort of part of civilization, that it's a grand thing that we have clothes. But actually, the fact that we have clothes, yes, they keep us warm, especially in cold environments, but they do effectively occlude most sunlight reaching our skin and prevent vitamin D from being formed in the skin. Now, this is good insofar as it prevents damage to the skin caused by ultraviolet radiation. And for those of us who live long lives, like many of our species today, we want to prevent cumulative damage caused by the sun to our skin. So clothes wearing is good from that perspective. But as you point out, we lose out from clothes wearing because we miss the opportunity, for the most part, to make vitamin D in our skin when our skin is covered with clothing. And so many people, as a result of habitual clothes wearing and indoor activity, develop slow, incremental vitamin D deficiencies, which can be severe. And these often creep up on people and are very sinister and manifest themselves only after they've been sort of grumbling for perhaps, you know, 2 or 3 years. I think many of your listeners may have had the experience of actually going to the doctor recently and finding out that they're vitamin D deficient. I'm not saying that people should strip off their clothes and run naked in the streets during the summer in order to compensate for this, but we need to be attentive to the fact that our lifestyles, including clothes wearing, contribute to vitamin D deficiency and that we have to attend to this.
I don't know. Good nutrition is good nutrition, right?
Good nutrition is good nutrition, and that helps as long as you're getting ample amounts of vitamin D in your food. And that is actually harder than you might think, because vitamin D is not present in most normally consumed foodstuffs. It's present only in a few oil-rich fish, like sardines and mackerel. It's not present in most other fish. And it's also found in supplements. And so you can take readily available vitamin D supplements and compensate for the vitamin D that you're not making in your skin. So to get to your second question, the physiological effects of vitamin D deficiency are many and varied. And the good science behind vitamin D deficiency is getting better by the day, so that we're beginning to appreciate all the range of health problems that are probably attributable at some level to vitamin D deficiencies. Firstly, we have problems with bones and bone weakness and rickets in children. These are very severe problems. Secondly, and more invisibly, are problems having to do with impairment or weakness of the immune system, which renders people with deficiencies more susceptible to infectious diseases, everything from the common cold and flu to tuberculosis and serious chronic infectious diseases. And then there's also an indication that vitamin D deficiencies are implicated in seasonal affective disorder and other problems that people feel when they're not getting enough sun in the wintertime, as well as some autoimmune diseases. I think this is a case of watch this space. There's going to be much more that is going to be made public about the many effects of vitamin D deficiencies in the next 5 years.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Nina Jablonski. She's a professor of anthropology at Penn State and author of Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. In the book, Dr. Jablonski provides a detailed explanation of the biological variances that lead to so many different shades of skin color in humanity. She also explores how humankind, from its earliest civilizations to today, has sought to categorize itself through this particular biological trait. We welcome your questions and comments for Dr. Jablonski at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And next up is Bob in Champaign. Hi, Bob.
Hi. My question deals with the issue of facial continence and the such that I can readily understand the pigmentation modification because of latitude issues and such, and sun angle, but how did we evolve different facial characteristics, the difference between the Asian face and a Middle European face, for example? Was that also based upon the fact that our latitude was different?
This is a good question, Bob. The evolution of our facial features is something that's fascinated biologists and anthropologists for literally centuries. And some of these factors are related, or some of these characteristics of our face can probably be related to environmental characteristics, but to different ones than can be brought to bear in skin pigmentation evolution. One important point I want to make is that pigmentation genes and the genes determining facial features are completely different, and so we rarely get them traveling together, as it were, in the human genome. So we can have people with light skin and flat noses. We can have people with light skin and pointed noses. Similarly, we can have people with dark skin and pointed noses, or dark skin and flat noses, and things like this. So I wanted to make that point first. But getting to your question about do facial features reflect the environments in which people live, probably the answer is both yes and no, in that some features appear to be related to environmental characteristics, especially to temperature. The shape of the nose, for instance, appears to be due to or related to environmental temperature and possibly also to average levels of humidity. But the question of eye shape, which you brought up interestingly, may not be related to the environment. There were old hypotheses brought forward that, for instance, the characteristic almond eye shape found in many East Asian populations was an adaptation to strong winds. This does not seem to be the case. What is more likely is that this particular eye shape may have evolved by accident as a result of a genetic bottleneck in the ancestor of modern East Asian populations, and that this genetic bottleneck actually resulted in this this shape of eye that has neither sort of good or bad consequences for vision. It doesn't really affect vision one way or another. It was probably caused by a neutral mutation that became fixed in the ancestral population. And so it doesn't really mean that it's adapted to the environment in any way.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Bob.
Okay. Thank you.
And let's go next to Eleanor in Champaign. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi. Two quick questions. One is, my doctor wants me to take 1,000 milligrams, I think, of vitamin D a day, but I'm taking ICAP, which also has vitamin D, and drinking soy milk and other things that may have vitamin D. It gets very confusing. Can you take too much vitamin D? And the other question is, if you go out in the winter with your jacket on and your face just gets exposed to the sun, does that do much good?
Right. With your taking a now, first of all, I should mention, I'm not a physician. I'm an anthropologist. So I talk to a lot of physicians, but I can't pretend to be your physician. So having said that, I can say that 1,000 international units of vitamin D is perfectly okay to take in conjunction with the other sources of vitamin D that you're getting from your multiple vitamin and from milk or soy milk. We can't really overdose on vitamin D that we eat in our diet. You would have to eat a tremendous volume of vitamin supplements in order to suffer from hypervitaminosis D. In other words, too much vitamin D. And this is a very, very rare problem. And it only causes problems physiologically in people who have a disorder of calcium metabolism. So I would say you're fine. Assuming all other things being equal and you're a healthy individual, then taking 1,000 international units, in fact, is probably a really good idea. And you can maybe even get away with taking more. In most individuals, in most adults, if you take 2,000 international units a day plus some that you get from dietary sources, that is enough to maintain a healthy level of serum vitamin D for most people most of the time.
Are you sure you're an anthropologist?
Well, I talk to a lot of doctors.
Yeah.
But I don't want people to say, well, this anthropologist said,
Well, I do want to go back, though, to a previous caller's question about eye shape and other body changes and steer us towards the point of your book as you examine societally how we have looked at skin color and how various civilizations have perceived it. I want to start by asking why it is that skin color became the trait that so many different civilizations throughout humanity have used to define or create groups or categories of people. Why could it not have been eye shape or tall people versus short people or something like that?
Right. First, we need, again, to think about humans in a broad evolutionary context. We are visually oriented animals. Like all of our primate relatives, we really rely on visual input to identify people, and we use skin color as a method to identify one another. We pay enormous attention to skin pigmentation, and one of the reasons that we do is that if you think about looking at a person at a distance, often you can only appreciate their color. Now, they may be wearing clothes, in which case you appreciate the color of their clothes, but if you're on a beach in the summer, for instance, you can, out of all of the characteristics of a person, mostly just appreciate their color. And so skin color is really the foremost visually relevant characteristic. And we are visually obsessed primates. So we pay a lot of attention to this. And skin color allows us to determine if someone is closely related to us or not. And in the early days of humanity, when we didn't move around very much, skin color was something that was mostly all the same. People would look around and look at members of their group and see basically the same color around them. What changed? Especially what changed around 1500 in a very dramatic way was that people started coming into contact more routinely with people who looked quite different in skin color. Earlier in history, there were contacts between people. For instance, if we go back to ancient Egypt, we know that there were lots of trading contacts between lightly pigmented Egyptians living in northern Egypt along the lower Nile and people living in the upper Nile in areas that are now part of modern Sudan who were much more darkly pigmented. Trade contacts existed between these people and there were lots and lots of felicitous interactions and diplomatic interactions and these interactions were routine and uneventful. But the interactions that started around 1300 or 1400 AD were different in that these were sudden movements. People especially venturing from Europe or occasionally Asia to sub-Saharan Africa, encountering people who looked much different from them in skin color. And these contacts then occurred between groups that had no previous experience in trade or diplomacy. They simply beheld one another in mutual astonishment. And what this meant was that there was a lot of shock, and the shock was transmitted to their home societies in different ways. We have, for instance, a lot of records from Equatorial Africa of people who recorded the appearance of odd-looking white Europeans in sculpture because they found them to be so unusual and arresting in their appearance. Similarly, light-skinned Europeans who beheld dark-skinned Africans for the first time recorded in writing their impressions. Now, you can see there's a little bit of an inequality here. The fact that the Europeans recorded their impressions of Africans in writing meant that those impressions could be transmitted very readily through the printing press. And many of the accounts from European explorers and travelers about Africans and African skin are not flattering, because many Europeans found black skin to be something they simply couldn't understand. They couldn't get their heads around why people should be near black. And so they found it disturbing, inexplicable, and when they wrote about it, they often wrote about it in terms of being disturbed. And the negativity of these diary entries and travelers' accounts spilled over into the accounts written up of African people by naturalists and philosophers. In other words, the written accounts had a disproportionate effect on how people framed their ideas of darkly pigmented people. And this really had an effect on how Western Europe framed its conceptions of Africans through time. Because increasingly, dark skin became associated with something that was inexplicable and something that was potentially evil and associated with forces of darkness. And this is where we begin to see the beginnings of a modern polarity of skin color, with dark skin being viewed as something unpleasant or negative and sinister, while white skin was associated with positive forces of light and beneficence. And this differential treatment of color is something that literally colors human interactions from then on and still affects us in many ways today.
We're taking your questions for Dr. Nina Jablonski, a professor of anthropology at Penn State University. She's the author of Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. You can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll take more of your phone calls after a short break. This is Focus.
So brave. On the next Fresh Air, Showbiz Dogs. Susan Orlean tells the story of the real Rin Tin Tin, the dog who was rescued from a World War I battlefield and became a popular silent film star. His character was later revived on TV. And animal trainer Bill Berlone tells us about taking a shelter dog and training him to co-star in Annie on Broadway. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Sinfonia da Camera, presenting No Holds Barred Beethoven on Friday, November 2nd at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert. Pianist Ian Hobson conducts the Emperor Concerto and Symphony No. 9 with soloists and chorus. More information is available at 333-6280.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're talking with Nina Jablonski, a professor of anthropology at Penn State University. She's the author of Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. In the book, Dr. Jablonski provides a detailed explanation of the biological variances that lead to so many different shades of skin color in humanity. She also explores how humanity, from its earliest civilizations to today, has sought to categorize itself through this particular biological trait. We welcome any questions or comments you may have, and one question I have for you in particular, and I'll pose this to Dr. Jablonski in a bit, is whether you think we might ever find ourselves in what we would comfortably characterize as a post-racial society, where truly we live out Dr. Martin Luther King's dream of people being judged by the content of their character and never the color of their skin. Is that possible? And in your mind, is there a difference between recognizing a physical attribute and making a judgment about a person's character based on that attribute? Put another way, can we be post-racial and still recognize and honor race? To join our conversation and share your thoughts on that, or to pose any other questions or share other comments that you may have, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. We will go next to Honora in Urbana. Honora, welcome to the show.
Hi. First of all, I want to say, Dr. Jablonski, your book was excellent. Thank you for writing it. And in your book, you talk about colorism and the pressure in contemporary culture to modify skin color. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
Yes, that's a great question, Nora. Colorism is a widespread phenomenon. And for those listeners who may not be familiar with this, it's the term given to a preference in any group for more lightly pigmented people, and concomitantly a bias against people who are more darkly pigmented. Colorism is an unfortunate plague that has really become a worldwide problem. We can see that its effects have deep economic and social problems in the United States as after effects of slavery, but also in the United States, colorism is seen in many Latino and other people of color communities because there is such a negative valence or negative value attached to darker pigmentation. And so this phenomenon is certainly not limited to the United States. We see it throughout Asia. It's very marked in India, for instance, and parts of China. We see it also in various parts of Africa and the Caribbean. And colorism definitely is a force of social evil that causes distress and personal anxiety to literally millions of people. Because many people feel that their skin is too dark and that their dark skin prevents them from having good job outcomes, they may feel that they're prejudiced against in a job interview, for instance. Or they may feel that a prospective spouse or mother-in-law may think that their skin is too dark. Because of these feelings, many people in the United States and throughout the world feel that they have to resort to lightening their skin. And there are all manner of legal and illegal skin lightening or bleaching agents that are now used, and they're widely available in markets around the world. This may be something that many readers are unaware of, but there is a huge market for these substances in the United States and in Asia, Africa, and the Caribbean. And the fact that people feel driven to use skin lighteners in order to try to improve their social prospects and their social status is very lamentable. And so I would hope, and this is getting to your question, Craig, I would hope that we could eventually get to the position of being a post-racial society, but we are a long way away because color is still associated with various positive and negative cultural attributes. Many people associate degree of color and depth of color with level of civilization or types of behavior. These old definitions of races that still sort of are around our necks are very real definitions in that they impact people every day. But race, as many people experience it, is a combination of physical features as well as cultural or behavioral features that were erroneously tagged on to physical features a few hundred years ago, mostly by people who didn't know any better. And so there is in the minds of many people the idea that those with more pigment in their skin have less intelligence, less ability to be civilized, and basically less of everything that we would consider sort of interesting and worthwhile. This is a potent force for evil and bad treatment of people throughout the world. The fact that we associate color with behavioral and cultural attributes.
Well, you know, even if we didn't make that association, you were talking earlier about this concept that humanity has this tendency to classify things, to sort of put everything, including people, into categories or buckets. Is it then something innate within us that will always make us make some sort of distinction about skin color? Not necessarily a judgment, but a distinction that, that is a distinctive face compared to that face.
Yes, I think we will always make these visual distinctions because, as I pointed out, we're so visually oriented. So we'll always notice a person's eye color, skin color, face shape, or whatever. But we will not attach any negative stereotypes to those features if we have never been taught to affix those stereotypes to the features. So it's one thing to see it and make an assessment that, oh, yes, this is something different or interesting. It's quite another thing, psychologically, to apply a pre-existing stereotype that has been introduced to you by cultural means. And that is the step that we can prevent through education.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there's still time for your questions and comments for Dr. Nina Jablonski at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, and we'll go next to Dick in Urbana. Good morning.
Good morning.
And what's your question or comment?
It's a comment rather than a question. I spent a great deal of time in Asia, and as she said, there is a prejudice there against dark-skinned people, but in a very real sense, it was not, not an unjust bias, because working people, farmers, spent a lot of time outdoors and got heavily burned and dark. Now, many of them were no more dark than the elite who stayed inside. But the very fact that they were dark indicated that they were of a, quote, lower class. And I wonder if that has a parallel in any other societies, because I've seen it frequently, where the very fact that they are sunburned and tanned and dark puts them in a lower class. And when I was growing up, as a Caucasian, the people that were taking care of me didn't want me to get tanned because then people would look down on me.
Hmm. Dick, this is a really good point. And I elaborate in my book a lot on the phenomenon that you have just outlined. because we see in all agricultural societies a preference for people with lighter skin who don't have to toil outdoors and who don't have the visible signs of sun exposure. So whether we're talking about European societies before the tanning craze of the mid-20th century, whether we're talking about East Asian or Southern Asian societies, the pattern is very similar. People who toiled out of doors and had the suntan to prove it were considered to be of lower status. And there was always preference, especially in marriage partners, for people who would be more lightly pigmented because it was assumed that they could literally afford to stay inside and not have to work out of doors. So this is a very widespread phenomenon. And it's interesting that in all agricultural societies that we see this, and this preference for light skin arose independently of the preference for light skin that evolved and arose in, for instance, the American South during and after Civil War times, because in the American South and in other areas where African slaves were admixed with Europeans, we see a whole range of skin colors and a preference for light-skinned people in that gradient. And that was as a result of those light-skinned people often being the offspring of the slave masters, rather than the fact that these light-skinned individuals necessarily were living indoors. So we see today two different reasons for preference for light skin, and the one that you outlined is very, very common in the agricultural societies of Asia and Europe.
We have just a few minutes left. I want to try and get in at least one more call. We have Terry on the line from Mattoon. Hi, Terry.
Hi. One of my anthropology teachers years ago told me about the when the Orientals took over the Japanese island and there were white indigenous people that they wiped out. Was this also due to colorness?
Well, this is a very interesting thing, Terry. The indigenous people of Japan are called the Ainu, and the Ainu are lightly pigmented. They're much lighter than most of the Japanese who came to the islands of Japan in the time of the Tang Dynasty in China several thousand years ago. So what we see there is not so much a color superiority, but rather the Japanese, the sort of the Neo-Japanese who invaded the Japanese islands recently and displaced the lighter-skinned Ainu, considered themselves to be culturally superior, and also they called the Ainu the hairy people, and they considered them to be of lower birth and lower status because they had more body hair and more resembled animals, and they considered them to be more animal-like than human because of that. So it actually, the skin color of the Ainu did not bear on this as much as the fact that the Ainu had a different culture and that they had more body hair on average than most of the Japanese.
Dr. Jablonski, in our final minute or so, I guess I just want to ask that one key question. Is there a possibility of this idea of a post-racial society? Is such a thing, in your view, possible in the context of the fact that we may always notice, if not obsess, over skin color?
Yes, Craig, I think it is possible. But we have to have the motivation to make it so. We can't just say, oh, we live in a post-racial society. That's not good enough. Because right now we live in a society in the United States that mostly ignores the deleterious effects of dark skin and that ignores the plight the discrimination that is visited upon people with dark skin. So we can't just sort of offhand say, yes, we live in a post-racial world. We have to really engage in the positive educational programs that will allow people to understand how skin pigmentation evolved and how people treated one another on the basis of skin pigmentation. We can recognize now how skin evolved and how we treated one another completely erroneously, fallaciously, and dangerously differently as a result of our misconceptions. We need to tell our kids about this. Then we have a chance of living in a post-racial society and world.
Nina Jablonski is a professor of anthropology at Penn State University and the author of Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. Dr. Jablonski, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me on the program, Craig.
And we welcome any additional thoughts that you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On Monday's show, we'll discuss the future of book publishing, the growth of the e-book industry, like the shift of daily newspapers and weekly magazines to online services with ever more limited or completely eliminated print editions, suggests we could be closing in on a day when we just may live completely without the printed page. Is that actually possible? Will there still be a place for good old-fashioned books 10, 20 years from now? We'll talk it over with Amanda Gome, co-founder of Digital Bindery. It's a company based in Portland, Oregon, which provides digital conversion services for publishers and independent authors. We'll examine the future of books, whatever it may be, and the publishing industry. That's on Monday's show. Today's program was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.